Welcome to ID the Future from Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. In this third segment of William Dembski's appearance on the Gilmore and Glahn show, Gilmore and Dembski continue their wide-ranging discussion of the current state of the intelligent design movement and where the science is headed over the next decade, as well as the slowly growing number of prominent scientists and scholars who don't accept intelligent design, but also are challenging Darwinian evolution as a failed theory.
I want to ask about some specific elements in your field or in intelligent design, but first of all, where would you, just to speak generally, and maybe it's not a fair question, Bill, and if not, just reformulate it to what you think is manageable, but where would you, not to be too cute, where is the evolution of intelligent design in 2015, would you say? Because you certainly go back from many years and you either know people personally and for a long time in the field or know of them. So I think I'm asking the right person this question.
You raise a good question. I mean, where is the field? Because in a sense, I think you can place the origin of the modern intelligent design movement in the mid-80s to early 90s. Thaxton Bradley Olson, Mystery of Life's Origin, was a book published in 84. Michael Denton, Evolution of Theory in Crisis, molecular biologist, wrote that in 85. And then Philip Johnson, Darwin on Trial. I think that circle of books and ideas and people, I think, really starts the movement. It starts more as a critique of existing evolutionary and origin of life materialistic scenarios. Then I'd say in the late 90s, we get more of a positive formulation. My book, Design Inference, with Cambridge University Press, Michael Behe, Darwin's Black Box. And so you have, I think, ideas that start getting developed, but also get short-circuited. I mean, you were involved with my whole controversy at Baylor University trying to get an intelligent design research center going at Baylor, and you read that this was the first intelligent design research center. It's also the last. It's been 15 years, and there's still no university that has sponsored an intelligent design group. I think the 2005 Kitzmiller v. Dover trial, in which the school board decided to push an intelligent design textbook called Of Pandas and People, they left themselves open to ACLU suit. It was, I think, the rule that the law that they had instituted or policy was ill-conceived, and I think that hurt us. You know, I mean, I think people like to be associated with winners. I mean, right. We just got through the NCAA. I mean, you know, I'm sure Duke has a lot of new fans and followers, you know, because people like winners. And so I think we've taken some hits in terms of the public perception of intelligent design. For me, that just got me working harder on the theoretical foundations. And that's where my work with Bob Marks and the Evolutionary Informatics Lab started focusing. But you yourself were involved with that in 2007, 2008, as Bob Marks's lab was removed from Baylor and the server. You know, and so you know about that. And then also you were there when he was interviewed for Expelled, this film with Ben Stein on intelligent design. So that documentary, I'm not sure that we've seen that much movement since, at least in the U.S. If anything, I think there's been a hardening of positions by the people in power in the academy and in the intellectual world. I think it used to be that they would try to engage us, we'd be doing debates and things like that. I think that happens much less. You saw this with my talk at the University of Chicago and Leo Kadanoff. I mean, it's only because Leo knows me and respected my work for him as a student way back that he invited me and did so over the objections of Jerry Coyne. I think a lot of people would have just folded and would have rescinded my invitation. And I think that's what's been happening. So I may be more negative than some. If you were to call the Discovery Institute, they might tell you something different. But I think 15 years ago, I thought that by the time I hit 65, intelligent design will be the dominant position, that Darwinism will bite the dust. I'm now going to be 55, so it's about 10 years, but I'm not that confident about it. On the other hand, I saw what happened with the Soviet Union in the 80s. I mean, early 80s, it looked as though it would continue forever and be this juggernaut. And by 1989, the Berlin Wall was coming down. So I think Darwinian theory is in bad shape. The evidence, I think, just keeps going against it, especially from molecular biology, because the complexities there just keep increasing. And basically, Darwinian theory and its modern formulations, they still have to run everything through natural selection. I mean, that's the designer substitute. And it has deep problems, and it's not explaining what we find in biology.
Why don't you elaborate just for a minute, and then I'd like to go off on a tangent about where intelligent design is. But how is it that natural selection is increasingly unable to explain these things? Is it because when we go to the molecular level, we see cells which look like a variety of different factories and almost designed robots and that type of thing?
Well, that certainly is part of it. I mean, I think perhaps the best metaphor to describe a cell these days is as an automated city. What do you need in a city? I mean, you need garbage collection, you need food supplies being brought in. You need a whole array of transportation, distribution, information processing systems. So you've all these things that are going on there. And so I think even the minimal cell is going to require that. So how do you get the first cell, I think, becomes a real problem. And Darwinian theorizing doesn't really explain that. Now, once you have an initial cell, Darwinian theorizing is supposed to explain how you can get increasing complexity of life. But even there, you've got tremendous problems. And the thing is, it's just that if you try to understand life in broadly evolutionary terms, it seems that living things are doing things that aren't just non-Darwinian. So when I was speaking at the University of Chicago last year, one of the people at the talk was James Shapiro, who takes a view. He's written Evolution, a View from the 21st Century. He's thoroughly non-Darwinian, and he'll say, look, organisms are doing their own what he'll call natural genetic engineering. They're not just responding to environmental stimuli and trying to survive. They're doing creative things to adapt to the environment in ways that are fundamentally non-Darwinian. So if you go online, if you do a Google search on the third way of evolution, you'll find a whole community of biologists that are saying, we're not going to be creationists, that's not scientific, but we're not going to be Darwinian. In fact, when I was talking to James Shapiro in his office after I gave my talk, I was trying to at least say, well, you know, I think Darwin had some valid insights. You know, I think that natural selection, actually, when you model it in terms of some sort of evolutionary algorithm on a computer, it offers some interesting search optimization approaches. But when I said something like that to James Shapiro, he dismissed it. He thought that Darwin across the board was bad news for biology.
Wow.
So he was even more anti-Darwin. You should get him on the program.
Right. Well, we should have you both on for an extended discussion. It would be fascinating. That's interesting, Bill, because that doesn't seem to be bleeding out into the larger culture, that there are non-creationist, substantive, thoroughgoing, serious, sober, scientific challenges to the Darwinian model. It's this black and white type of thing that we've been used to, I think, for so long, which of course only, well, it's the end result of polarization. And I think from the materialist viewpoint, as you've said, the public dialogue is reduced. Thank goodness for your friend at the University of Chicago who didn't fold. All we hear from the front lines of colleges these days are canceling a Jan Hirsi Ali's honorary degree or shutting down speeches because some snowflake might have their feelings hurt. It's remarkable. In any event, let me ask you about something that I thought was fascinating. I think it's been out a few years now. I don't know how long. I don't know if it's as old as 2010 or maybe 2011. But for listeners, a very famous and well-known philosopher, Thomas Nagel, came out with a book, only 128 pages, called Mind and Cosmos. And Bill, I thought the reaction to that book made the Jerry Coins of the world's reaction to your appearance at the University of Chicago seem like a firecracker compared to a warehouse of TNT. And to put it simply, Nagel remains a committed atheist and a materialist, but he was trying to feel his way along the lines of a materialist-only approach to explaining how we got here, who we are, evolution, the whole Megilla. And in the introduction, said some kind words about people in the design theory. And he didn't necessarily agree, but what he basically said, and correct me if I'm not getting it Exactly right, Bill. He basically said you don't have to agree 100% in order to appreciate the value that they're doing, because materialism, as we currently understand it, is insufficient to explain consciousness. It's insufficient to explain mind. And maybe there will be another, almost another dimension of knowledge and understanding that will come to the rescue. But for current purposes, he said the materialist approach was coming up empty-handed.
Well, that's right. I mean, and Nagel, I mean, he is a huge towering figure in philosophy. I mean, when I was a graduate student, everybody had read his essays and books and The View from Nowhere and What's It Like to Be a Bat. So he's a big figure. He's in his 70s now. And as you say, he's an atheist. Now, I want to be careful here to distinguish materialism from naturalism. He is not a materialist in the sense of a materialist reductionist where everything can be reduced to material entities and their interaction and the patterns that emerge out of that. He thinks that there's something richer to nature than that. And yet he's not willing to go the theistic route. He thinks that basically nature has some sort of built-in teleology, and he even will refer to teleological laws that he's trying to understand, which is actually very interesting, because when I first read that teleological laws in his book, I dismissed it because I've heard of people talking about teleological laws in the self-organizational world.
And could you just explain that for our listeners, Bill? What do you mean when you say teleological laws?
Teleological refers to end-directed or goal-directed, and so it's laws that will take you to a goal. The idea with materialism is that there are no goals in nature. It's just you've got matter is this big shmoo, and it organizes itself in various ways, but there's nothing that it's striving towards. It's not going any place. It's just matter arranges and rearranges itself. And so to have some sort of telos where there's an end to the, let's say, matter organizing itself into a living form, and that's somehow built into the world. From a materialistic vantage, there's no reason that life should be here at all. I mean, Stephen Jay Gould would talk about this. Why are we here? Because of thousands of accidents. I mean, that's basically what you're stuck with. There's some sort of physical necessity and chance and their operation together, and that's what accounts for everything. And so Nagel is proposing something more than that. He sees nature as being a richer set of possibilities. But as you note, he's not an atheist. And so, right, I mean, consciousness, mind, and origin of life, he sees those as beyond the remit of purely materialistic processes. And you see scientific evidence bearing on that. And that's one reason he was lifted his hat to the intelligent design movement. Not that he buys the whole intelligent design program, but he thinks at least we brought up some valid criticisms and problems with Darwinian theory. And so he gave us credit for that. But yeah, I think he at least opens the door to the sorts of things we're doing and has been very congenial. My book, Being as Communion, there are about two chapters devoted to engaging with his work. And we, in fact, had an email correspondence, and I quote him there from one piece of our correspondence with his permission, because I thought he put it better than he did in his book. You know, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, as we see defections like this and honest thinkers who say, look, I mean, this materialistic approach doesn't work, I wonder if there may come a shift at some point. I think one thing we have to realize is this Darwinian materialism is as fundamentalistic as the young earth creationism. It's offering a very simple storyline. And this is the appeal of fundamentalism. We're going to give you something very simple, bite-sized, and you can swallow it and you can disseminate it. It's just natural selection, filtering these different variations. That's how we get it all. For the young earth creationist, it's just a knee-jerk, literalistic interpretation of scripture, and you don't have to think anymore after that. You can get on with life. And the idea that the world may be a more complicated place, and that things may not all be clear, and that alternative views that we may not like may still have a place at the table in the classical liberal tradition of a John Stuart Mill, that just seems increasingly unacceptable to people these days. And I see it as a fundamentalist dynamic, and I see it in a lot of different guises.
How then, going forward, do you overcome it? You and Professor Marx and other thinkers at the Discovery Institute, which is in Seattle, radio talk show host Michael Medved frequently showcases people from the Discovery Institute, given that he's located in Seattle. Is it just the sort of thing that you've been doing, sometimes with a higher profile and sometimes with a lower profile, in as you said, looking at the theoretical foundations of intelligent design through the lab and Professor Marks? And do you get responses outside of your area to that work that you do, which is on a high level and strictly scientific and strictly computational and mathematical?
Well, I think we do get some people who are interested in the work, but there's several things going on. Discovery Institute started out as a high-tech public policy research think tank, and so their approach with intelligent design has been two-pronged. I mean, one is the cultural element. How are these ideas playing out in culture and trying to get some fairness to the discussion of these ideas and the implications of intelligent design? But the other thing is actually to develop it as a scientific research program. And so they've been committed to both sides of that. I think for my own sanity, it's helped just to be focusing more, at least in the last 5 to 10 years, on the scientific underpinnings of intelligent design and let go of the cultural, because I used to be more of a cultural warrior. I had a blog and I'd just get into it with people on the other side. And eventually I just wearied of that. So I think for me, it's put my nose to the grindstone and do the work and just keep going at it. But I think in some ways it can be disheartening to see the reaction to this, because I mean, the Evolutionary Informatics Lab is still not on the Baylor server. And then there's a digital evolution lab, I think, at Michigan State University with millions of dollars of funding from the National Science Foundation. And they're basically trying to justify evolutionary theory. We've analyzed their models. I think we've refuted many of them. And yet they have all this public funding and they can just keep going on their merry way. And if our work is inconvenient to them, they can blithely ignore it and the world goes on.
Join us for more of John Gilmore's interview of William Dembski on the next episode of ID the Future. For more about Dembski's latest book, Being as Communion, visit beingascommunion.com. For more coverage and commentary on the debate over evolution and intelligent design, be sure to visit Evolution News and Views at www.evolutionnews.org.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2015. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.